report by Israel's Hotline for Refugees and Migrants, NGO. It describes treatment by Israeli authorities of detained migrants akin to torture. Migrants, according to the NGO, are being hit with belts, have lack of contact with the outside world, and receive just moments of free time in the open air in Israel.
14 months you've been in the detention facility in the south of Israel. And 14 months you make connections, like you said. You are living all day for 14 months with people. And one day they are seeing you getting out of there. How do they feel about this?
I mean, it is really very sad that being incarcerated there for 14 months. There are a lot of people also for more than that. And there is no any justification at all. They release me without, telling me why. And I'm sure that they gain nothing of incarcerating somebody like me or others who are in Holocaust right now. There is no gain out of it at all, other than torturing some other human beings.
In one location alone, there are 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women. They are living in subhuman conditions that fail to meet legal standards. A new report by an Israeli human rights group paints a picture of humiliating treatment towards foreign workers and migrants. It shows the extent of unlawful arrest and actual physical violence that they face. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies. It revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where migrants are detained. The report states that dozens of detainees were imprisoned for months in several detention facilities all across Israel. In fact, according to the report, authorities in these facilities used extreme methods to control the detainees. These methods include beatings with a belt and the forced use of sleeping pills. One such facility is the Yahalom Detention Center. It is located at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, the capital. In 2019, it held approximately 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women in subhuman conditions that failed to meet legal standards. Many of the tortured migrants come from Africa and Southeast Asia. Israel's YNET News cites care worker from the Philippines who worked in Israel for 15 years as saying, "The three of us were locked in a small room, without a TV and without our phones that were confiscated." The report also found that immigration inspectors are now breaking into places of residence by force. Additionally, the report claims that in 2019, there was a sharp increase in the number of deported families. It claims that the actual total number of deportees amounted to 6,694. The data and evidence reveal conduct that violates the High Court's directive and even the immigration authorities' own procedures, according to Sigal Rosen from the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants.
Main trends we identified were detention of those who denied entry to Israel, preventing those who have been denied entry from applying for asylum when they wanted to. There was cases of violence by immigration authority inspectors towards detainees. In the last year, there was a special problem of detention of families with children, school children, ahead of their deportation from Israel. During the last year, the Immigration Authority started focusing on efforts to detain school-age children. This population was previously spared from detention and deportation, but in the last year, the immigration started arresting these children, especially in order to deport them. Unfortunately, the Israeli immigration policy is to allow the immigration of Jews only, and whoever is not Jewish and is not entering to Israel under the law of return, but under the entry to Israel law, the Israeli government is doing whatever in its power to arrest and deport him. well, if Israel doesn't want non-Jews to live in this country, then they just don't need to bring these people. Right now, and actually anytime, there is more than 100,000 legal migrant workers that the government is initiating their entry into the country. It is not reasonable to invite all these people and then to deport them. And this is already amount to torture. Detaining a migrant who committed no crime just because Israel failed to deport him for such long years without any prospect for release is definitely a torture.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Traf Lab says COVID-19 made the situation of some of the most vulnerable workers worse and introduced some highly restrictive targeted policies that had grave impact on their lives. Hopefully, it also created an opportunity to rethink policies and reassess how to address vulnerabilities. Bryn says Israel's crimes include ethnic cleansing, bouts of genocide in Gaza, torture of children, theft of land, targeted killings and murder, house demolitions, and myriads more since the squatter entity was unilaterally declared in Palestine by a Polish immigrant in May 1948.
The facts are that Israel signed the UN Convention on Refugees, which means that they're supposed to give refugees and according to international law, regardless of the convention, but they're supposed to give refugees safe haven if they're leaving from a country where they're in trouble, where they're in danger. And obviously that's not what's really happening on the ground. They face a lot of racism, they face a lot of legal and bureaucratic issues. So on the one hand, on paper, Israel is supposed to be treating them in a different way than what's happening on the ground. Of course, I mean, in any country, when an immigrant or an asylum seeker comes for work or to flee danger, they're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Because of language, because of legal issues, because of all kinds of things, and so it's easy to exploit them. Here, we have a particularly difficult situation because, as I explained, most of the asylum seekers are not getting legal and social help from the government. And so, you know, they need to somehow be able to raise their families, to feed their kids. So if they're, you know, working under the table or working at restaurants and being taken advantage of, the system is sort of set up to do that rather than to help.
Okay, so yes, in general, I think there's a fundamental racist problem in Israel. It has always been an issue in Israel. The targets of the racism have changed. It was either at the beginning, I would say, the Arab population or the Sephardic population, what we call the people that came from north of Africa and Yemen. They suffer from systematic racism towards even from the beginning. And of course, now that we have the Ethiopian Jews that came to Israel 20, 30, 40 years ago, and of course, the asylum seekers coming from Africa, they all suffer from a systematic racist problem in Israel. It's quite unbelievable, even. It's heartbreaking, and you can see the results. Actually, the Ethiopian Jews. I was in a trial yesterday of Salomon Tuka, a young Jewish Ethiopian boy that was murdered by the police. That he was shot by a police officer. We have succeeded to raise awareness, and there's a trial going on, which is quite exceptional. But we know that the trial will not bring anything, and the policeman is not blamed of murdering the boy. He's complaint of, I don't know, some sort of something else. But in general, we have a long list of young Ethiopian boys that are being imprisoned, criminalized, killed. So of course, when it comes to even the Jewish black community, the asylum seekers suffer from it much more. I think basically it stems from the fact that the Jewish community that established the Zionists, that has established Israel, came from Western Europe countries, East European countries. I think they all suffer from racism until today. So basically, we brought the racism from Europe to Israel, when you think about the people that established Israel, including my great-grandparents and my family from both sides. So I think they came with the notion that anything that is not European is not equal to them. And of course, I think it had to do with the fact that we had to basically, we're committing ethnic cleansing towards the Arab population in that was here in Palestine. So in order to do that, you have to make them subhuman. And I think that, you know, echoes the way we treated the community, the Jewish community that came, as I said, from the northern part of Africa or from Yemen. They received the same treatment. They have been, their culture, their language, everything that they brought with them was valued as less, as not as good as the coming things that came from east of Europe. So basically, I think it's something that's rooted in the Zionists and the Jewish society here in Israel.
The daunting report reveals a sharp increase in the number of immigrant families imprisoned for the purpose of deportation from Israel. And for the first time, it also aimed to detain students. Such torture of migrants is not new. In 2018, the United Nations said that migrants in Israel suffered from abuse and torture before they were ultimately deported. The UN refugee conducted research into the subject and highlighted 80 individual cases of people who risked their lives after they were relocated by Israel and then had to make hazardous journeys to Europe through Libya. The UN said that migrants suffered abuse, torture, and extortion before risking their lives once again by crossing the Mediterranean to Italy after Israel had sent them away. In April 2018, Israel reached an agreement with the United Nations to expel around 16,000 African migrants to Western countries in exchange for granting temporary residency in Israel to the same number. Shortly after, however, the deal was cancelled by the Israeli regime.
All these years, actually, since 2013, when Israel started sending asylum seekers to Rwanda and Uganda, only asylum seekers who decided to move to these countries left. No one was taken there by force. It is correct that many of them felt coerced to go there because of the heavy decrees and laws that locked them down in prison, in Cholot, all the economic decrees that took away such a large amount of their salaries and left them with no means to live. The international law brutally, when it deals with both asylum seekers and migrant workers. We see in the case of migrant workers that people are detained in illegal condition, not just according to international law, but also according to the Israeli law. And regarding asylum seekers, we see that Israel do not bother to check the asylum claims, detain them, coerce them to move to other country, and limit their freedom of movement in a way that violates the Refugee Convention.
On social media, the conversation was tense. suburb says that an Israeli court rules the city to be a white city and that schools for blacks or funding transport for black school children to attend school elsewhere are liable to alter the city's demographic balance. This could incentivize blacks to move into the city, damaging its white character. Fatima says that the crimes that are happening all over the world against the oppressed Yemenis, Palestinians, Afghans, Indians, Chinese, blacks, etc. are being planned by the United States and Israel. The international community must protest against these atrocities. Ali says the extinction of insects and reptiles is important to the United Nations.
And there are different types of immigrants in Israel. There are migrant workers and there are asylum seekers, as I said. But it's very, very difficult to naturalize in Israel if you're not coming and making aliyah, if you're not coming as a Jew from a different country and trying to live here permanently. It's nearly impossible to naturalize here, including if you're an immigrant, a non-Jewish immigrant that wants to marry or marries outside of the country a citizen. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and the legal system is not set up to help migrant workers and refugees, and this is why they're a vulnerable community in Israel. And so, even things like getting social services during a global pandemic, as I said, the deposit law was canceled, but there are lots of other issues and social benefits that other people living here, citizens mainly, are receiving that these people are not receiving because they're not really recognized.
And I'm here in order to make a change. We have a prime minister who's divisive, who is splitting the country, who is ruining our economy, and who is undermining the structure of democracy.
I'm coming here to protest for 6 months because our Prime Minister he's criminal, and he's kind of dictator, and we want him out.
Basically, Israel does not respect any international law. Neither it doesn't respect international law, the refugee convention. The Geneva Convention, sorry. It has never been committed to anything in the Geneva Convention regarding asylum seekers, regarding refugees, but it also does the same thing towards the Palestinians. There are no international laws, none whatsoever, that Israel respects. Even the deportation, they found a system with these third countries, I call them the revolving door, Rwanda and Uganda, which they did not even allow to say their name in courts. By the way, I went to Uganda, and we also had connections with parliament members of Uganda. That's one of the reasons that his program has failed. We collected testimonies, and we know that Israel has done everything it's in its power to either walk around these international laws or disregard them in general. I would even say that the Supreme Court of Israel itself does not respect the international law. It doesn't say so out front, but it definitely does everything in its power to override these international laws. Can public pressure create a change? No. Public pressure, if it's not, governments cannot create a change, okay? The whole BDS movement, which basically Israel is very worried by it, cannot really create change because we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private people, NGOs, or whatever. If the only way, I think, basically, if you ask me, and this is what we have worked towards with 2018, when we were hoping that the deal with the UN would go through. Israel will never accept its small amount of asylum seekers. We're talking about a very small, we're talking about less than 30,000 asylum seekers that are even not called asylum seekers. They're called infiltrators. They're called infiltrators by the court, by the Supreme Court. No, these people will never receive fair treatment. They will never be considered human beings, basically.
The migrants that have been tortured include workers that have been working in Israel for decades. They are cheap labor and working conditions that Israeli employees do not. They do not receive any incentives or benefits. In fact, many of them do not see their paychecks in years. Israel has been allowing this to go on for decades. To many of these migrants and laborers, they are being treated as modern-day slaves. Israel has promised them savings forcefully cut from their paychecks if they leave. Israel has been wanting them to leave for years. Now, it is executing mass imprisonment of this minority group of people. It remains to be seen what actions the UN will take after the latest torture report in Israel. Here is the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. The father of Facebook Israel CEO and an active protester against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was killed after being struck by a car during an anti-Netanyahu protest at the entrance of the city of Sabion. Police ruled out any intention to harm by the driver, a woman in her 20s. The Times of Israel. Hackers published sensitive client information stolen from Sherbet Insurance after the company refused on Friday to pay the approximately $1 million ransom demanded. The group responsible for the attack, Black Shadow, had said that if the requested sum of now 200 bitcoins was transferred into its account, it would not publish or sell the information. I-24 News. Amir Peretz, Israel's economy minister and head of the Labor Party, announced that he will be running for Israel's presidency in 2021. Peretz, who was the military minister during the 2006 Second Lebanon War, made the announcement in an interview with Army Radio. Israel's current president, Reuven Rivlin, is set to step down in mid-2021, with the Knesset, Israeli parliament, tasked with electing the next president. Ynet News. Two Israeli teenagers have been arrested on suspicion of sexually abusing two small children over a period of 2 years, the police said. According to the police, some of the abuses of the children, aged 4 and 7, took place inside a local synagogue. During the covert probe, the investigators gathered findings and collected evidence from several children, which helped them to uncover the affair.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya, and then later they were moved to Najaf, and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard from our teachers, or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16, and he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
When we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts, theories, and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers all across the nation of Islam. With me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. We want to discuss one of the most important theories of Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, titled as Mantiqatul Faraq. Sayyid Mohsen, Assalamu Alaikum, welcome to your show.
Alaykum Assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Rizazadeh, Assalamu Alaikum, brother, welcome to
your show. Alaykum Assalam wa rahmatullah. Good to be here.
So in our last episode, we give our dear listeners a background and introductory remarks regarding the concept of Mantiqatul Faraq. We can say, as Sayyid Mohsen defined it, It is a scope of domain of religion in which the Islamic ruler has free hand or free powers in order to issue rulings based on the necessities and the circumstances of the day. Isn't it, Sayyid Mohsen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it's not about the fatwa only. Obviously, the Islamic rulings that we know in today's world.
Okay.
The technical meaning that we know, we relate to, like, we go towards the fatwa of a mujtahid generally.
That's right.
Whereas here, which in Mandaqatul Faragh, it is about, you know, it's an Islamic country, because the rulings that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the laws that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent, it is in the form of halal, haram, it's forbidden or it's allowable.
Yes.
Mujtahid, when he comes and gives a fatwa, it's generally, it says, this action that you're doing on the basis of, for example, the verses and the narrations that I have, or even if he does not have, on the basis of the principles that he follows, he allows you either to do that or he forbids you.
That's right.
But he is not issuing any new rule. He is not bringing a new rule, like Allah said, harama riba. The riba is haram.
Yes.
It's not like that.
This is the main question regarding Mantaqatul Faragh. That some of the, we can say, the scholars who criticize Shahid Assad for their theory, they say that Mantaqatul Faragh is in contradiction with the theory that Islam is a comprehensive and complete religion, and we can say has been born for the people, we can say, till the day of judgment. What's your answer to that, Sayyid Mohsen?
Well, there is no contradiction in having the Mantaqatul Faragh as well. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as I think...
So if it is complete, what is the need to the freedom?
I think in the previous episode, in the previous session, Dr. Lirzadeh has mentioned this.
Yes.
That we have two types of rulings. Mm-hmm. One is specific, which is sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There are some which are not specified.
Okay.
Also, you know, when we are saying like an Islamic ruler can make new rules, it is the part that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because this Islam is a complete set of religion...
That's right.
He has sent it till Qiyamah. It has everything in it. Mantaqatul Faragh is also one part of this, in which Allah has given free hand, in some cases, to the ruler of Islamic Ummah, that in some cases, according to the circumstances, he can change the rulings. He can make a new rule, and after that, that rule can be voided.
Or it's better to say he can make new interpretations out of the rulings, isn't it?
It's not new out of rulings. It's just a new rule.
New rule.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
That interpretations from the ruling or interpretations are done by the mujtahideen maraji.
Oh.
That is fatwa.
Okay.
It's totally a new rule, a new law, which is maybe applicable at the time of this ruler, and maybe it is not applicable at the time of the next ruler.
Okay.
So he can dismiss the rule,
he
can bring a new rule according to the circumstances that
Or sometimes
have.
The new concepts, I mean, we can say, or the new developments coming to the scene, for example, now we are living in the 21st century, new questions, new doubts, new phenomena come to the scene. So the Muslim ruler must have this power in order to answer them, in order to look at them, in order to, as you said, issue a ruling about them, isn't it?
Well, you're going towards the perspective of the mujtahid.
Okay, yes, I'm the early mujtahid, like.
Yes.
Now go to the...
It's all maraji. It's the duty of a mujtahid that a muqallid, with the circumstances, if there is anything which is related to himself individually. Because the examples that you're bringing, these are the individual example. That individual, according to circumstances, what he should do. Whereas when we are talking about the ruler, Islamic ruler, in the Mantaqatul Faragh, he is giving a new law, making a new law, as Allah made many laws. He has a free hand. In some cases, he has to make a law which the whole society, the ummah, is following, basically.
That's all right.
So main difference between the fatwa and the rule or the law that in the Mantaqatul Faragh a Muslim leader is making is between the action of individual and the whole ummah or society.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Dr. Razazadeh, but the idea and theory of Mantaqatul Faragh can be very much dangerous too. It could be like a knife in the hands of, I don't know.
Yeah.
For example, we could see some of the extremist groups nowadays who has selected caliphs for themselves, okay?
Right.
Like al-Baghdadi of ISIS, okay?
Right.
So he considered some freedom for himself.
Right.
He called himself the caliph of Muslims,
killing
here and there with massacre, you know, and going to the extreme. And he considered such freedom for himself as the ruler of the Muslim lands in order to do so.
So the potential, the power, the knowledge, and the capacity of the Muslim ruler is very important here, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, anything good in the hands of an improper person can be dangerous.
Okay.
So it's not the problem of that good thing. So this is a very general ruling that anything good, I mean, this does not have any exception. But what you say is very true in the sense of if this ruling, if this concept is being used by an unqualified person, it can be abused. This is why Shahid Sadr explains about the conditions of that. One very important condition is the person who has this freedom or this, let's say, this
power
in his hand is a jurist, is a qualified jurist, is a marja who is a ruler. Okay. Not any ruler and not any marja.
So it is not a ruler who is not a marja or a marja who is not a ruler.
In most cases, and that's the case. So the conditions are very vital to have in mind.
Very good. Do you have any other conditions for us to enumerate? Or is this is the only...
Yeah, for example, another major condition is that in that free area, anything that that jurist ruler says should not have any contradiction with the fixed laws of Islam.
Oh.
So because, as I said, we have two different types.
Yes.
And you know, this is very... Somehow, it sounds to be clear after this explanation by Shahid Sad, of course. Not from the beginning, but you know, because we have two different types of phenomena in the world. One are, as I call them, the dynamic phenomena or dynamic. I mean, the phenomena that have a dynamic nature, and the other type of phenomena and relationships or whatever we have in the world, including the relationships we have and the things that exist in the world.
That's right.
They have a fixed nature.
Okay.
For the fixed nature type of things, we have fixed rulings.
Mm-hmm.
But for the dynamic type of things, for the dynamic nature type of things, you know, the religion itself has given a type of freedom which is in the hand of the prophet, the infallible imams, or when, at the time of the occultation, the jurist ruler.
Okay.
And this is the necessity of the universe, because there are dynamic things in the world.
That's
there are things
right.
that change.
Okay.
And when things change, they need new answers, new responses, new reactions.
Yes. Thank you much, Dr. Zazadeh, for a nice answer. Said Mohsen Naqvi, but it seems that the Muslim, because a ruler over here, must have a mastery over different sciences, knowledge, or at least he must benefit from we can say the ideas of many advisors around himself, isn't it? Because if you want to issue a new law, as you said, based on the conditions of the day, he has to, we can say, have this power in order to reason, deduct, we can say, new things and give the interpretation, isn't it?
That's true. Obviously, he has to be most knowledgeable, obviously, because he is running the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
He is running the whole ummah. And if I can just give you a couple of examples
so that it becomes
like much more tangible for us.
Very good.
For example, you know, when we talk about the moon, the first moon of maybe month of Ramadan or Eid, we have a fight, obviously, dispute.
Yes. Yeah.
A marja says you cannot see the moon with any tools or any means. And you must see this
with the naked eye.
Other says like you can use telescope and all those. Now here, if the ruler of the Muslim Ummah comes and he says that when we announce everyone should celebrate Eid, for example, and he has his own reasons for that, obviously. And he says, for example, even if we see and they like have different points, for example, either they're looking with the naked eye or with the telescope, no matter.
Yes.
But the day when they announce, when he announces as a Muslim ruler, the whole Muslim Ummah should follow him.
Okay.
That's one example.
Yeah.
There are other example we can give, like, you know, generally it was in regards to the Hajj. We have many like rulings from different maraje that there is one Amirul Hajj, a leader of Hajj, a leader of the people who goes to the Hajj pilgrimage.
That's right.
And that was like in the Mina, they should pray behind him the salat of the prayer of Dhuhr and Asr.
That's right.
And he was praying Dhuhr and Asr the way Shia does. right after Dhuhr, praying Asr. There is no, you know, the gap between, like generally we have different timings.
Yes.
So
this praying behind him, and it is necessary, it is something which is related to the government, mm-hmm. not the specific faqih, because some of the fuqaha said it is mustahab, some said no, it is wajib, mm-hmm. and there are different rulings. Okay. So in the fuqaha, there are different rulings, and that's it depends right. on the individuals, whether they follow that or not.
Okay.
But when it is applied as a ruling as a governor or as a ruler,
a state ruling,
then
that's right.
a state ruler, then yes. the whole state should follow that
okay.
ruling.
Very good.
And it's obligation, it's an obligation even on the maraji.
That's all right.
They have to do that because he has mm-hmm. been given this free hand in okay. these cases. So these are these some examples which is necessary, when we give these examples, it becomes more tangible. For example, right. for zakat.
Yes.
Some of the fuqaha, they said it is mustahab to give to the faqih.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can spendings where you need to spend.
Yes.
You can give to fuqara, masakin,
yes,
ibn
sabil.
These right. charity, the zakat okay. that you can give, the wajib zakat, they have obviously the Quran, the verses of Quran has clearly said where you can spend this zakat.
Yes.
And some of them has said it is mustahab. But if the ruler comes and says it is wajib to pay to the faqih,
mm-hmm.
to the government, to the wali faqih, for example, who is the ruler, then everyone must pay that zakat to him.
That's all right.
Now, it's an order from the government now. From the point of government, it is an obligation.
Okay.
And this comes under the area of mantaqatul faragh, the mm-hmm. power that has been given to this ruler.
That's all right.
Although, individually, my mujtahid has said it is mustahab.
Mm-hmm.
But because the ruler, who is faqih, and who is wali, and who is the representative of imam,
mm-hmm.
therefore, if he says it is wajib to give to him, I have to submit my zakat to
That's
him.
That's all right. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Rezazadeh. There is still a lot to say about the idea of Mantaqatul Faragh and its relation to today's world. We can say some of the Muslim scholars have compared it with the theory of Masalih Mursaleh in the Sunni school of thought. And as Dr. Rezazadeh said, the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Naini has tackled this issue in his book, Tanbihul Ummah and Tanzihul Millah, which is a very nice book. Also, some say that Sheikh Al-Ansari has also presented this idea. And Shahid Assad, in order to organize and systematize this idea, has presented in his book, Iqtisadana. It was very kind of you. Inshallah, we'll continue Inshallah. Our discussion on Mantaqatul Faragh in upcoming session of the program. And thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Do not forget to visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanil.
A teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him? Ya Mu'allim, peace be upon you, truly you are our teacher.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be delving into the Islamic laws about the ladies according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of Ijtihad. that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, can a woman have sexual intercourse before she performs the ghusl for her menstruation, when the menstruation is over, all right?
Yes.
So we know that the menstruating women have to perform their ghusl,
yes,
their ritual ghusl or bathing, so that they could be getting rid of their ritual impurity, all right?
Yes.
Which we call hayz. So can the women have sexual intercourse before their ghusl?
That's good. Good question. It is recommended that the woman get perform ghusl, purify herself, and then have sexual intercourse with her husband. It is recommended. But of course it is permissible for a woman who is supposed to perform ghusl after menstruation, she wants to have, let's say, sexual intercourse with her husband, and she has not yet performed ghusl, she can have sexual intercourse and there is no problem. And then of course when she has sexual intercourse or intimacy with her husband, she can perform one ghusl with the intention of both ghusl janaba and ghusl hayz. Okay, so one ghusl can be performed with the intention of both janaba and hayz, even if janaba is not included in the niyyah, because the ritual purity is obtained with one ghusl, whether it is performed with the intention of janaba or with the intention of hayz. What is important is the ritual of purity, which is obtained by performing the ghusl with either the niyyah of hayz or the niyyah or the intention of janaba. And of course, to include both is also permissible. A woman makes a niyyah of both janaba and ghusl and hayz, and the ghusl is in order.
I see. So basically what you're saying, if you want me to reiterate it, that would be like one person can perform a ghusl with two niyyah.
Sure.
Or even a multiple niyyahs, right?
Yeah, of course.
All right, not even two, like more than two.
Yeah,
niyas.
More than two. Like for example, you want to perform ghusl jum'ah also, because ghusl jum'ah,
yes,
or the ghusl which is recommended to be performed on Fridays.
Yes.
On Fridays, that could be also included.
Yes.
And you will gain the sawab.
Yeah, but you have to do the niyyah like for the obligatory ones first, all right?
Oh,
and
of
then
course.
You can say it covers,
yeah,
the recommended ghusl,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, of course, yes. Because ghusl is not wajib per se.
Yes.
Per se. It is wajib because of the prayer,
mm-hmm,
because of fasting.
Yes.
Otherwise, if fasting and prayer were not obligatory, ghusl was not obligatory either.
Exactly. All right. Since you said that multiple ghusl can be, in fact, performed with one niyyah, in fact.
Yes.
All right. Well, let me ask you another question, which is quite related to that.
Yes.
You know, some women are in doubt that whether they have entered their menstruation or menstrual blood, and they, you know, have sexual intercourse.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and during sex, they may realize that this is the monthly period. What can they do there?
Yeah. She notices the blood.
Yes.
And she comes to know that she has got the monthly period.
Yes.
Yes?
So
of
she
course
can make sure,
yeah,
that this is the menstruation.
Of course, it's obligatory for both of them to stop.
Yes.
Having sexual intercourse once the man and the woman realize
yes.
that the woman's hajj has just started. Okay, the woman must, the man must withdraw and stop having sexual intercourse. That is obligatory because it is a grave sin.
Yes,
to have sexual intercourse during menses. And of course, if a man or a woman, both of them actually, commit this sin, they will be liable for kafara. The penalty is there.
Mm-hmm.
The penalty is very difficult to afford. It's not affordable
mm-hmm.
because it's more than three grams.
Yes,
3 grams of gold. If it takes place in the early stage,
mm-hmm.
if it takes place, if the sexual intercourse takes place in the middle stage, then it is 1 gram and 70. It's less than 3 grams. And if it takes place in the final stage of the menstrual period, then it is about 1 gram, less than 1 gram, okay?
But what about the middle stage?
The middle stage is 1.5.
Yeah. Right,
half of the first stage, okay?
The initial stage.
Yeah, the initial stage. So the penalty is there, and of course, in order for a person not to become liable for the penalty, he should not or she should not have sexual intercourse. Because not only the penalty is there, but it's also a grave sin. Because the Quran clearly forbids men and women to have sexual intercourse when the woman is in her menses.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
You talked about this penalty, this atonement, this kafara that
yes.
they have to pay.
Yeah.
When they, have sexual intercourse during the menstruation, all right?
Yes.
But who should this penalty be given to?
The penalty...
Because you said it varies from 1 gram of gold to 3.
Yes.
All right, to 3 grams.
Yes.
So who should this penalty, this the payment be given to?
It's not given to, for example, the woman... Or the woman is not going to give it to the husband.
Right.
It is given to either the religious authority who will spend it on urgent cases, or she or they will have to give that penalty to the poor Shia Muslims. Okay.
I see.
Whether Sayyid or non-Sayyid, this penalty is given to them, not to anyone else.
Sheikh Tobi, imagine this scenario that a woman has a regular monthly period and the menstruation discharge ends, all
yes.
right?
Yes.
And she becomes tahir,
yes.
clean, and ritually pure.
Sure.
On the seventh day, all right?
Yes.
And her husband goes to bed with her. Well, afterwards, the discharge reappears.
Yes.
And continues until the tenth day. All right?
Yes.
Is she sinful? And if your answer is positive, if so, is the kafara, the atonement, the penalty due?
Yes. First of all, Ayatollah Sistani says, when it comes to this question especially, Ayatollah Sistani says, no, the husband and the woman are not sinful because they were under the assumption that the woman is pure from menstrual blood And of course, the a peer woman, when she realizes that she is in, she's not in, she's no longer in her monthly period, she can have sexual intimacy with her husband. But all of a sudden, the man and the woman realize that the woman is still bleeding, and in that case, they should discontinue. They should not carry on having the sexual intercourse. Okay. But they are not sinful. This is what Ayatollah Sistani says.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
European News Bulletin.
Good to have you with us. My name is Amina Taylor, broadcasting from the British capital, London. Now we kick off with a developing story. After the European Parliament voted to lift the immunity of the former president of Spain's Catalonia region, Carles Puigdemont, and two of his pro-independence associates. Puigdemont and his colleagues became members of the European Parliament in 2019. This after they fled Spain following their failed pro-independence Catalan referendum bid, which was deemed illegal by Spanish authorities. Following the EU's announcements, Puigdemont's pro-Catalan party stated that they will not give up the fight for independence. The three individuals now face being extradited to Spain, which has issued European arrest warrants for the trio. Chris Bambury is with me, the political commentator and author of the book Catalonia Reborn, How Catalonia Took on the Corrupt Spanish State and the Legacy of Franco. You've been watching this for some time. Are you surprised that the EU did this?
No, I'm not surprised. The Spanish are desperate to get Puigdemont and the other two back to put them in jail, as with the other Catalan leaders who were sentenced to Oriol Junqueras, for instance, to 13 years for organising this referendum. I think the result was not going to be in any surprise. The three major blocs in the European Parliament, centre-right blocs and the socialist centre-left blocs, had all agreed they were going to vote for this. But actually, the result was much closer than would be expected. 58% voted for lifting the immunity, and you can do the rest of the arithmetic. A substantial minority voted against. And this was the first time that the Catalan issue has really erupted into the European Parliament and European institutions. Since that October referendum, which was suppressed by the Spanish using paramilitary police, the EU has stayed quiet on the question of Catalonia and what's happening there, because essentially it supports Spain. Now we have a debate in Europe about what is going on, not just in Catalonia, but inside Spain. And we should remember as well that this vote comes off the back of the imprisonment of a rapper, a Catalan rapper, for the crime of insulting the royal family and the Spanish security forces. That caused a debate on the nature of Spanish democracy. This is causing a further debate on the nature of Spanish democracy. Questions are now being asked in Europe, which is not a bad thing.
But how will this impact the independence push by Catalonia? We know that, of course, the pro-independence party won a slim majority in the last election just a few weeks ago.
Well, of course, a majority of Catalans in last month's election voted for pro-independence parties. But that hasn't stopped the Spanish continuing a heavy-handed policy, essentially of low-key repression in Catalonia, persecuting politicians, mayors, social activists, clowns. You know, someone who wore a red nose next to a cop, Spanish cop, was sentenced. This policy has been going on, but I think what's also interesting about this, the vote last night, the result announced this morning, is that up until now, up until recently,